Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, my co-host and artist for Smug Beat Games, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our special guest this week from Happy in the Laboratories, the lead designer of the upcoming game Energy Hook, Jamie Freester.
Hello.
Hi, Jamie. It's great to have you on.
It's great to be here.
All right. Now, normally when we invite an indie designer on, it's to just discuss specifically about their upcoming game. But for this week, I have an ulterior motive to have Jamie on, because he was a part of one of my favorite open world games, Spider-Man 2. He was the tech director and the man who prototyped the web swing physics for the game.
That's right.
And that was just one of my personal favorites. And last week I did a series on my favorite open world titles, and Spider-Man 2 was ranked number one, at least from my opinion, for having just a great moment-to-moment gameplay with the, as mentioned, web physics system.
Well, thank you.
Yep. So, with that web physics system, as we just said, you originally prototyped that system, and then, of course, the entire team at Treyarch helped develop it and put it into the game. So, how did you get started with developing that system?
Well, it was actually partway through Spider-Man 1. I was technical director on Spider-Man 1 as well, and we had sort of influenced by Neversoft's previous title. We had a swinging that was sort of, it was kind of just like flying, really. It was sort of, you kind of bobbed up and down through the air, your webs attached to the sky, and I've been a Spider-Man fan. I was a Spider-Man fan when I was a kid, and it didn't feel authentic to me. And I said, what if we had something that was sort of more like Quake's grappling hook mod? And I knew that Neversoft had done some experiments in that area, and they said, oh no, too hard, didn't work. And so I was like, well, what if there's some sort of artificial intelligence that helped you pick a point in the world to swing from? Would that make it accessible enough that we could put it in a mass market title like Spider-Man? So I stayed at work late, even though I was supposed to be working on Spider-Man 1. This was early enough that I was kind of harboring the idea that the tech would make it into Spider-Man 1 before we had to ship. And I stayed at work late and tried to make it happen by taking our game levels and sort of placing points around them that I thought would be fun to swing from, and then writing code to sort of automatically attach to the nearest best point. And it wasn't good enough. Like, even though I spent, a couple weeks of nights working on this thing, when I finally showed it to the team, it was like they'd swing around a bit. Spider-Man would stick to walls, and it was really kind of frustrating. And we said, there's no way we can get this. And we'd already gone so far with Spider-Man 1. It was like, there's no way we can get this tech into the game in time. And so it wasn't until Spider-Man 2 that we sort of gave it another shot and tried to see if we could fix the problems with the system I was working on with Spider-Man 1.
Now, with Spider-Man 2 being a open world game and Spider-Man 1 was somewhat of a linear experience, was the decision to make the second game open world, did that come from having the prototype for the web swing, or was that already a conscious decision in the early development?
Well, it was somewhat independent.
Okay.
I think it was quite possible that we were sort of developing the two technologies at the same time. And I think it would have been possible that if we had decided, this Jamie's crazy web swinging system just doesn't work, too hard, we're getting rid of it, we would have still kept the open world side. And likewise, if we'd found out, oh wow, this open world stuff is taking a lot longer to code than we expected, I don't think we're going to be able to finish that in time, that we quite possibly would have kept the swinging system. Fortunately, we worked out all the kinks with both systems and managed to get them in together.
Yep. Now, one question I have, this is probably going to sound like a very stupid question, as I'm not that versed in programming and physics in general, but as you're developing the prototype and using real-world physics to sort of model Spider-Man swinging on, how did you, I guess, base something that is entirely unrealistic with, like, a realistic physics system?
So yeah, it's funny, if you take a human-sized weight and attach it to a rope and then drop it from a swing or whatever, it's really kind of, and then you film it, mm-hmm. it's just not that exciting to watch in real life. It's pretty exciting to do, like if you've ever gone on like a giant swing at summer camp or whatever, it's a lot of fun to be that person, but just watching it is kind of dry. And so the Spider-Man movies, they turn it up to 11, right? They like, it's his web's elastic and he's moving hundreds of miles an hour through the air and whatnot. And so we had to, yeah, I mean, it started with sort of the basic physics that I learned my senior year of high school, but we turned gravity up to like 10 times its normal value. We cut your air resistance way down, and there's all sorts of other little fakey things we do that don't happen in real life that make the game just more fun.
Now, between developing it for Spider-Man 1 and then the actual final version for Spider-Man 2, was there any part of it that was, I guess, very challenging to work with as you were developing the actual version for Spider-Man 2?
The most challenging thing, I think, was introducing it to new players. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty tricky game mechanic. With most games out there, even the hardcore first-person shooters, it's still just, you know, point and shoot, right? Mm-hmm. It's very direct. There's not that level of abstraction where it's like, well, if I want to get here, I need to swing from over here, and then I can get here, and then I need to swing from over there to get here. It's like, it's indirect. It's not, and it's also unpredictable. It's mm-hmm. like you don't totally know what your webs are going to attach to because the game is sort of helping you out. It's hard to do the same run twice. Your web attaches somewhere slightly different the next time. You end up in a totally different place, which is totally fun. But when somebody's learning the system, it's pretty crazy. And so that all through development, that was the sort of thing we were most worried about, was what can we do to make this more accessible? Because, you know, we're expecting to sell millions of units of this game, and we want to make sure that everybody who buys it has an okay experience.
Yeah, and as you were saying about how in most open world games, or just in most games in general, movement or basic actions, they're pretty simple. They're meant to be something that you can do automatically. You don't really need to think about. And
right.
That's always been one of my issues, or one thing that hurts my enjoyment of a lot of other open world games. When the movement or your basic interaction is so simple that your brain basically just gets put on autopilot as you move from, you know, mission one to mission two, or from one end of the city to the other. And one of the things I really did appreciate about Spider-Man 2, and that I mentioned in my piece, was that you couldn't turn your brain off. You always had to be engaged with how you were swinging, how you were maneuvering around, because as you said, it wasn't a precise science. You weren't always going to know exactly where you're going to end up at any given swing.
Right. Yeah. You and I are one.
Now, after Spider-Man 2, of course, the open world genre did take off. Were there any open world games that you played following Spider-Man 2 that you enjoyed as much, or you enjoyed for different reasons?
Well, I loved Ultimate Destruction, the Hulk
yeah.
game, and for different reasons. I mean, like you said, getting from point A to point B fairly direct in Hulk, but you know, you could also grab a helicopter and throw it at another helicopter, and that was rad.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that combat system because it really did add another touch. And Spider-Man 2 also had a similar system. It's been a very long time since I played Spider-Man 2, but I did remember it didn't have exactly a direct combat system like Hulk, but you did have like a lot of jumping. There are a lot of combos, and it was just much more than pressing the X button, you know, 20 times during a fight to wear down a guy's health bar.
Although nothing really stopped people from pressing the X button over and over just to punch people mm-hmm. into oblivion, but we provided, I hope we provided enough rewards for people who wanted to sort of explore all the other things Spider-Man could do in a fight mm-hmm. To do it, and a huge part of the combat system of Spider-Man 2 is being in the air, right? Like mm-hmm. you'd punch somebody in the air, then you'd jump up and you'd keep on punching them in the air, and then you'd web them in the air, and then you
mm-hmm. Now, another part of Spider-Man 2 that I thought was interesting was the upgrade system, when you unlock new abilities, not just in combat, but in movement. I remember there was like a slingshot that you could like slingshot up a building, or ways to make your webs like swing faster, or the zipline. Were those
right.
elements that had to be played into the physics system as much as general swing, or did they operate under like a different type of system?
Well, they integrated with some of the like the speed ups. That was basically lowering your air resistance as far as the physics was concerned. I think there might have been like things that let you have a longer. I forget. It's been 10 years, right? I think we had things that let you do have a longer web line, stuff like that. And so yeah. In a sense, it changed the parameters of the physics. A lot of them.
Yeah. Now, following Spider-Man 2, Treyarch also worked on Ultimate Spider-Man. Did you have any part of that development or worked on that game?
Not much. It branched off from Spider-Man 2 about halfway through Spider-Man 2's development. A separate team headed that one up. So it used our engine, took it in a new direction.
All right. Now, of course, one question I have to ask, you may not be the right guy for this, but I just have to know, why did Treyarch move away from the web physics system between Spider-Man 2 and Ultimate Spider-Man? Because I thought that was such a very great groundwork system that it just seemed weird to move away to more of like the traditional, you know, you show web and just sticks to nothing kind of deal.
Ultimate was still pretty good in that regard. You still had to swing from buildings. It definitely had a different feel. I mean, Ultimate was supposed to be comic-y, and it felt comic-y.
Yeah.
You were very, like, in Spider-Man 2, you feel very heavy, and, like, you feel the gravity and the momentum as you're swinging around a corner, and Ultimate's sort of like you're jumping around and being a spaz, and it's cool in its own way. I think it wasn't until Web of Shadows that you could start swinging from the sky again.
Yeah.
And I wasn't there for that. I don't know. You know, I can imagine why they made decisions like that, but I wasn't there, so
yeah.
I can't say for sure. They've generally, I feel like they've generally been trying to make it more and more accessible over the years, to the point now where with Amazing, you just sort of press a button and watch a movie of you swinging.
It definitely is a shame that we didn't see more of a complicated system. Not so much like complex as in, you know, you need to be a rocket scientist to figure out, but just something to keep the player engaged as they go around. And as I mentioned in my piece, one thing that I'm surprised we haven't seen yet is another superhero game that takes on that theme of like a day in the life kind of deal, instead of it being this epic story, you know, over 3 hours or something. Like Batman, Arkham Asylum, Arkham City, they were great games, but they were pretty much locked into, you know, one night as Batman.
Although at the end of Arkham City, at least you can go around and do day to day Batman stuff and solve the little things.
So, what was the last game that you worked on at Treyarch before you moved on?
At Treyarch, so Treyarch, I worked on Spider-Man 3 for almost a year before I quit, and so that was like 2005, something like that. So a while ago.
And when did you form Happy End Laboratories?
Just about a year and a half ago, depending on how you count. Between then and Happy End Laboratories, a friend of mine and I started Torpex Games, and our biggest game was a game called Schizoid for Xbox Live Arcade, which was all about which is 2D top down. It's like color coded cooperative Pac-Man.
Cool.
It's really fun if you can sort of get past the if you can A, find somebody to play it with, which is always a challenge. B, you know, if you can get past the sort of early learning curve, it's got sort of a hump you have to get over. But once you do that, it's just awesome. You'll be trash talking with your friend in no time.
All right, so let's move on and talk a little bit about, of course, the big game that you're working on now, Energy Hulk. So, for the people who aren't familiar with it, could you tell us a little bit about what exactly Energy Hulk is?
Okay, so Energy Hulk is sort of homage to the game mechanics from Spider-Man 2. It was like, now that Spider-Man games aren't doing that kind of gameplay anymore, you know, I kind of just want the gameplay back. So it's, you have a gravity, it's the future, and you have a gravity beam, and you use that gravity beam to swing from building to building. And you have a jetpack, which doesn't let you fly. It just lets you do sort of these assisted jumps in midair as you're swinging around. And you have these gravity boots, which let you run on walls. But then the game is all about the movement. It has no combat. It has almost no story to speak of. It's like a sport of the future. So in a way, it's kind of like a love child between gameplay reminiscent of Spider-Man and the Macross trick doing game. Gameplay of a Tony Hawk or a SSX wrapped into one burrito.
Nice. Now, Energy Hulk, of course, was on Kickstarter, and I have to ask this question. This is my customary question for any developer who has a successful Kickstarter project. Did the idea for Energy Hulk come before Kickstarter got big, or was this sort of was given birth after Kickstarter sort of became known among the public stage.
I definitely had the idea before, like, wow, I sure would like to just, you know, make a game that focused on swinging mechanics. But I always sort of assumed that it wouldn't sell enough to be worth doing. And so a couple things kind of happened at the same time to where it was like, wow, maybe this is really possible. And one was I started playing around with Unity, the game engine I'm using, and I realized just how easy it is how easy it would be to make a game all about the swinging these days with modern technology. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, Kickstarter games started happening, and we started seeing, wow, look at, you know, these games that sort of trade on nostalgia are getting funded. And so it was like, yes, you know, now is the time for my nostalgia game to actually, you know, maybe I can really make it happen.
Now, another part that I have to ask about with the Kickstarter is the fact that you set the goal at $1, which is pretty interesting. Could you talk
about
that?
Yeah, I seem to have made some Kickstarter history by doing that. It's like, at least I haven't heard of anybody else who's really done the same thing, and certainly haven't heard of anybody else who's gotten, you know, over 4 million% funded. And so, yeah, and basically, you know, when I originally started working on the project, I intended to do a normal Kickstarter where it was like, you know, where I chose some concept art and say who I was and say, please give me a ton of money to make this game a reality. And I probably would have overestimated how much it would really take because I'm old and I'm used to games this size take a team of a dozen or two dozen people 2 years to make. And so it was still hard for me to fathom that, you know, I could practically do this game almost mostly by myself. And so it's a good thing that I didn't do that, because I would have asked for too much money and probably the game would be dead. But I started working on the prototype, though, while I was working on the Kickstarter pitch. And I showed the prototype to people, and they were always like, oh, don't do the Kickstarter yet. It's not quite ready. You need more to show. And after almost a year or 9 months of doing that, it was like, wow, this game has come so far. It's already like a minimally viable game. It's like, this is a game you can play and have several hours of enjoyment with. I'm gonna finish it. If my Kickstarter, even if I only raise $1 with a Kickstarter, I'm still gonna finish this game. And so that's sort of where the $1 thing came from. It was like, I didn't want to lie with a Kickstarter. I didn't want to say, oh yeah, I'm only gonna make this game if I can raise $50,000. Because I've seen people do that. I've seen people like do a Kickstarter and the Kickstarter doesn't make it. And instead of packing it in, they're like, oh, yeah, we're going to look for other sources of funding now. So it's sort of like, you just tricked me. I was like out there telling my friends that they had to, you know, donate money to make your game happen. And now you're telling me you're going to do it anyway. So that was the motivation.
All right.
Yeah, I think it's really cool because you gave people another option, right? This was never even an idea for other people. They always said like at, you know, like 20, 30K as like a very low cost for one. But, you know, you gave the option for $1, kind of giving the concept that, you know, I was going to make the game anyways, but I would love your support. At least that's how I interpreted it. And I think a lot of people appreciate that.
Exactly.
And basically you're saying that, you know, donate the money, I'm still going to make a game, but if I get a lot of money, I can take this idea and take it and really run with it. And from the Kickstarter, looks like you've got a sizable amount of stuff added to the game. The first person mode, Oculus Rift, more content. Now, about Oculus Rift, I find it interesting that a few weeks ago I wrote a piece about the Oculus Rift saying, I don't know if this is going to be that big. I don't know what game I would like to play with. And then I found Airtrail. I was like, okay, I can see this working.
I don't know. It's funny because I have the opposite perspective because I actually own a Rift. And I think it's when you try the Rift is when you start becoming a real believer of VR. Mm-hmm. And I always think it's a little weird when you play a game that's third person with the Rift. But
which is why I added a first person mode. I was sort of
right. I would, but yeah. So when you said that, when I actually saw that you had that option, I was like, man, I would get so violently ill. So how are you dealing with that motion?
Oh yeah, it is sickening, I'm not sure that's ever going to be fixed. The next generation of hardware is going to be better. And on the one hand, I'm doing what I can and following the advice and guidelines to keep the motion sickness down. But on the other hand, it doesn't feel like one of the things you're not supposed to do is rotate the horizon line, right? The player is supposed to be able to tilt his head, but the game world's not supposed to tilt.
Exactly.
But if you're running on a wall, and your head doesn't tilt, it doesn't feel like you're running on a wall. So I'm letting it make people sick because I want it to feel like you're running on a wall, even if it makes you sick, rather than, you know, keep your head straight, yet you're on a wall, but it doesn't feel like you're on a wall. I'll probably put like a checkbox in the pause menu or something like, do you want the more immersive, more nauseating experience, or do you want the scale back, doesn't feel like you're running on a wall, but makes you a little less sick experience too? And also the third person mode is also less nauseating, and it is actually pretty cool. It's kind of like, oh, you're sitting in an invisible chair, following the character around, and it's kind of cool in its own way.
So here's a question. Are you going to support any sort of like motion controllers, like the Hydra?
You know what? If you have any contacts at Hydra and you can get in touch with them for me, yes. But they don't. They haven't answered my emails to them. So
Sixth Sense, I believe the term. They created the tech behind Hydra. They're doing a Kickstarter on the 12th.
Oh really?
Yes, for their new wireless STEM system. It's really cool. It has not only is it wireless, which is great, finally, but it also has 5 positional trackers, so you can like turn around and stuff, and it'll actually follow your body. So it's like a big thing that's coming out. And they're definitely reaching out for developers for support.
Well,
should send them a mail.
I mean, I did. I sent them a mail six months ago, and they never got back to me. So.
They are on a PR blitz right now. They would definitely would be like, Energy Hook, yes. So you should definitely send them a mail. They're really nice. I mean, they've already messaged me back. So.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, you tell them about me, and maybe they'll...
hey, guys, Energy Hook.
Maybe then they'll realize that I'm not just some guy spamming them. Like the Hydra, the Razor Hydra people. When I emailed them, they didn't look at the email at all. They sent me back a thing that thought I was a pro gamer looking for sponsorship.
Well, that's because it's Razor. the company behind it is Sixth Sense. I can't pronounce it right, but I had to look it up. But they were, they're definitely looking at trying to like broaden their group and finding people to, you know, they're offering dev kits and stuff too. There's actually a competition right now if you go to their site to get a free STEM system before the Kickstarter starts. Bam. I don't know why I'm so like all about this, but I'm always on the Oculus forums and stuff like that, which is why I'm all about all the new tech that's coming out for it. But anyways, that's beyond what we're talking about. But yeah,
I think it could feel really great. There were a lot of problems. There were a lot of problems with the Wii version,
right? So there's a lot of problem with what?
There was, you know, people complained about the Wii version of Spider-Man 2 or 3. I forget which one it was. I guess it was 3, where you're kind of whipping your hands to shoot your webs out. But you know, even though the graphics weren't at the same level as Treyarch's version, I did think that the feeling of whipping your hands out to shoot your webs did feel pretty cool.
Yeah, I think with the wireless STEM system with the Rift, that would push your game into an amazing simulation of, you know, the hook and swing, except for the whole feet. And you know what? You don't even need the feet thing. So you don't even need a treadmill, right? You don't need the Virtuex. All you need is the STEM, and then you just need the Rift, and that's it. You have brand new experience.
So regarding the Oculus Rift, one question that I'm curious about is regarding how do you see it as a viable product for the consumer? Because this is one area that Ken and I are sort of on different sides of the debate about. As I wrote, I'm still not sold if this is going to be something the consumer base is going to adopt readily. I know Ken is very excited about from a design perspective and as, you know, a new device or a new tool for designers. So I'm just wondering, having worked with it, what are your thoughts on the Rift so far?
Well, I think it's much more interesting place for games to go than like the next generation of consoles. Like if I was a consumer and I had a choice between buying a next generation console or an Oculus, I think I'd want the Oculus just because that's going to give me a whole new set of experiences, which the next generation consoles just is not going to do. So that's really cool. The motion sickness thing is a worry. Like, will people not bother because of the motion sickness thing? But I think it'll be okay. I think partly because I think, you know, Oculus is working on it, and they're adding, as I understand it, they're adding the feature that'll let you sort of move your head side to side and have it update correctly, and that's going to help a lot with motion sickness. And also, people just sort of get used to it. Like, you might get sick the first time you play it, but you build up a resistance. You get used to it, and you know, back way back when, people used to get sick playing first person shooters, right?
Yeah.
They kept doing it anyway. They still ended up being pretty popular. So
yeah, I've heard of a few people that I've spoken to on forums who get like that feeling of like seasickness when they play first person shooters still. But as you said, I think part of it is you just have to build sort of like a resistance up to it. It's like the same thing about actually being on a boat. A lot of people get sick the first time they're on a boat, and then your body just gradually adapts to it.
Right. Virtual reality legs.
Yes.
Without the salt water in your face.
As soon as we've figured out the screen door effect, it's going to be a pretty awesome experience. So, yeah.
So, let's go back to Energy Hulk and discuss a little bit more about the gameplay. So, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, you're aiming for this to be sort of like a futuristic sport type situation. What type of gameplay or what type of events and such will the player be able to interact with in Energy Hulk?
So it's kind of like a mix of both SSX and Tony Hawk. You've got the sort of SSX, like, you know, get from point A to point B as quickly as possible, where doing tricks earns you energy that you can then use as boost to go faster and therefore get to the finish line quicker. And then there's just a more Tony Hawk-ish, do chains of tricks, string them together to earn a combo, get the biggest multiplier and coolest tricks you can, and don't repeat yourself. Just how many raw points can you earn in that time? And those are kind of the two main modes of play. But and like Tony Hawk 4 and like SSX 3, there's a certain amount of, you don't have to do any challenges. Just you swing around from challenge to challenge. But if you sort of forget what you're doing and you just start swinging around aimlessly and picking up collectibles and just being zen, that's awesome. Like, and that's how I played Tony Hawk. That's how I played, you know, that's how I played Spider-Man 2, Tony Hawk 4, and SSX 3.
Yeah.
Like, I would do the challenges, but I'd also spend lots of time, you know, just playing, just for the sake of play.
Yeah, and that's a pretty good point about SSX 3 and Tony Hawk 4, because those are also some of my favorite titles as well. Just as you said, they're great games to just relax and get into that zen feeling of just going down the mountain, doing tricks, and even just, you know, going off the beaten track and find random collectibles hidden thereabout. Now,
right.
And you actually answered my other question about Angel Hulk. Is it going about if it's just these event-type situations, or there's this actual world, in a sense, that is linked to and from the different events?
So it's kind of like the conceit is some Energy Hook athletes have sort of set up these teleport gates in these different small cities. They then use to travel, once they have enough cred in the league, they use them to travel from one arena to the other. And so it's kind of like, so it's a bit like Tony Hawk 4. It's not like a big open world. It's like a bunch of linked, it's not like a big sandbox. It's like a bunch of linked, tinier sandboxes.
Okay.
And you use the teleporter gates to go from sandbox to sandbox.
Now, will there be any kind of, like, character progression in the sense that you would unlock maybe longer hooks or faster swings or stuff like that?
Yeah, and it makes a lot more sense than it did in Spider-Man 2. It's like, I'm buying superpowers in a store. No, you're buying better gear, and you can tune your gear and tune your gear's interface to the way you want to play.
Okay. Now, we talked about single player. Are there any plans for, like, multiplayer or co-op races or stuff like that?
Not right now, no.
Okay.
That was a pretty expensive stretch goal in the Kickstarter, because in my experience, adding multiplayer to your game makes it take twice as long to finish.
Yeah.
So we didn't hit that. There's possibilities. You know, I shouldn't say anything. There's the slightest possibility I could come into more funding and make stuff like that happen.
All right.
But for now it's a single player experience. Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago regarding a trick system. How do the tricks work in Energy Hulk?
So that's still in flux. I kind of just got some of the mid air tricks in a few weeks ago. Right now it's one of the sort of bread and butter tricks is, after you let go of your rope on a swing, you can press certain buttons to do different poses, like a cannonball pose or a leg grab. And then you can also use the D-pad to spin and flip around while you're doing that. You can mix those up and get a bigger multiplier, and then, you know, hopefully catch yourself with another swing before you splat in the ground at the last second. Right. And if a wall's coming, you can go into wall run and run along the wall. And that acts in a way like grinding did in Tony Hawk and SSX, like, it's you, that's the way where you're racking up smaller amounts of points, but over a longer period of time. And, so a long wall run can build you up a lot of points.
And sort of like the way to chain the different tricks together to make the long combos.
Yep.
Okay. Now, you mentioned gamepad. Is Energy Hulk able to be played with a keyboard or a mouse, or is the gamepad more like the preferable option?
It supports both of them, and the people I've talked to are about half and half split, which is their favorite. Mm-hmm. So I feel like my work here is done. They must be, you know. Mm-hmm. There's advantages and disadvantages to each one. I prefer the gamepad, but the mouse lets you turn the camera on a dime, and that's pretty cool too.
So you talked about the two types of events you have in the game so far, the race and the trick. Are there any ideas that you have in the back of your mind for like future content or future events?
Well, there are a bunch of challenge levels that I have a sort of protege, a guy who's been designing some sort of abstract challenge levels, and they're just can you get from the beginning of this level to the end of this level type deals, and they're all abstract, just shapes and colors. They don't look like part of a city, but they remind me a bit of Mario 64. You know how some of the Mario levels were look like a world, but then others were just more blocky. Can you do this puzzle? And so it's sort of like, I don't know what the story is, why there are these, maybe you're in some kind of virtual reality in the game where you're doing these challenges. But yeah, that's another thing that's in there.
Now, in terms of development, how do you see the game when it's like released? Like, do you see this as being a complete experience or as something that you'll continue developing following the actual public version?
Hopefully it makes enough money that I can keep developing it. Because, I mean, I don't know, I just have, you know, infinite ideas about what I can do with it, but I also have to feed my family, so...
Yeah. Well, have you thought about the idea of what other developers are doing and releasing, like, it on sale for an alpha or a beta?
It's already available. Yeah. You guys didn't know it was available?
I knew.
He knew. Yeah. I didn't. But yeah, it is.
EnergyHookGame.com. Everybody go to EnergyHookGame.com.
Go, guys, go. And now I am acknowledged that it's in the alpha, so guys, check it out.
I'll have a link to the page for as well from Happy and Lab as well. So with the game being in alpha, I guess...
Good segue.
Yeah. How has the experience been? You talked a few minutes ago about how people are generally split between keyboard and gamepad, but how has the general opinion been of the actual gameplay so far?
Well, it seems like everybody loves it. So that's not blowing my horn too much. I mean, they also have lots of valuable feedback, which I'm sort of plowing my way through and trying to implement. Generally, they just a ton of nice things to say about it. They get, you know, people get lost in it. They start playing and hours go by and they're like, wow, that's a good game.
And that sort of sounds like what I was talking about, what we were talking about a few minutes ago with Spider-Man and Tony Hawk. And when, like, the basic gameplay is engaging enough, it really lets you get into that zen or flow state. And
right.
Then it just becomes a very great experience. Now, one question I have regarding the alpha and the pricing you have is when the game moves into beta, when the game moves into retail, are you planning on changing the pricing structure of the game at all? Because I know with Introversion and Prison Architect, that's what they were sort of aiming for. They're aiming for having a higher than normal price alpha, and then the game will become cheaper for beta and then cheaper for release.
Yeah, absolutely. The alpha price is the price you pay to be able to play it before anybody else does, and to get in there and be able to give feedback while I can still act on it. And yeah, so the Kickstarter gives you an idea of how the prices are going to change. Like once it's in beta, it'll be $10 cheaper, and then I'm not totally sure what I'm going to retail it for, but it'll be at least. But when I finally retail it, it'll, you know, be at least 15, maybe 20, something like that.
Now, I saw on your pricing for the alpha, it says all future updates included. Does that include, like, if you do decide to develop the game past retail, like, does that include, like, future expansions or future updates? Because I know with Kerbal Space Program, they did run into a mini controversy regarding their wording and their terminology with that.
Oh, really? I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah, what happened was when they did the Kickstarter for the game, they're doing an alpha that it actually started out cheaper. They went sort of like the Minecraft route, that if you buy the game way in the beginning, you know, version 0.05, version 0.10, it's only going to cost you $10. And then as they keep adding more content, filling out the game more, they raise the price. Right now, I think it's $22-$25 to basically buy into the alpha. And so the issue that they ran into was when they announced it way back during the early days, they said that if you buy it, we'll give you all updates all updates to the game. And people thought that meant all future, you know, post content from here to, you know, in perpetuity to whenever the game officially ends. And they eventually had to clarify, and they said that we'll let anyone who bought the game from this date and before that gets future content for free. Everyone else would have to effectively buy the expansions or content packs or whatever.
Interesting. Yeah, I wasn't even imagining really doing DLC or content packs, so I didn't really think about that. But I was thinking that if I do an Energy Hook 2, that certainly wouldn't be included. But obviously, okay. Energy Hook 1.0, 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, 1.9 yeah. would all be part of it. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about DLC.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things that we're seeing a little bit more with Kickstarter, and just as more fans, I guess, get involved with the game development, it's sort of like a mixed blessing. I think we talk about this with other podcast guests, that it's great on one hand that the consumers, they have a hand making the game, but on the other hand, you know, if you piss them off or they don't like something, of course they're going to hoot and holler at you and, you know, say, hey, I gave you $40, $50, or I gave you $100, you better listen to me. Something like that.
Happily, so far, I haven't gotten anybody like that. Like, everybody who's paid the money seems to be really satisfied, really happy with what they're getting.
All right, now, one question that I forgot to ask you when we were talking about Kickstarter a few minutes ago, another thing I'd like to ask developers who have had Kickstarter projects is, what do you think of Kickstarter or crowdfunding as a viable platform? Because it's still, I wouldn't say it's, you know, in infancy, because it has been around for a few years now, but it's been about a year since it really took off for game development. And there's still debates about whether or not this will remain a viable option for game designers in the future.
I love it, and I think, I don't know where I'd be right now if it wasn't my Kickstarter. I would have had to have finished the game by now if I hadn't been either on to my next game or looking for a day job or something. And so it's been awesome for me. And I have a theory, like every time there's a new platform, right? People are super excited about it, and the first few, and if it's a good platform, the first few games on there do awesome. And we've seen that over and over again with Xbox Live Arcade and Steam and iOS. And so in a way, you could think of Kickstarter as being another new platform, but and then with all those other platforms, they saturate, and there's, after a while, no matter how good their systems for discovering new content are on the system, people get left behind, and new cool new apps get launched, and then nothing happens. You think of like the horror stories behind Retrograde, if you've heard any of that. It's like, you know, this is an award-winning game, highly reviewed, and absolutely tanks on PlayStation Network, and then doesn't do too well on Steam either. So it's like, it's sad. People get sort of lost in the shuffle. I don't think that's going to happen with Kickstarter, because there's so much less clutter. You're allowed to be on Kickstarter for 1 month or, you know, two if you push it, and then you're gone, and that gives an opportunity for new titles to come in and be in the spotlight. There's no Angry Birds or whatever sitting in the top slot forever, preventing other titles from being seen. I'm optimistic that Kickstarter will remain a thing for a long time.
I think it's like an everyone wins kind of situation, because, you know, you don't have a problem with the shop thing, because you're getting visible, you're garnering an audience before the game's even out. So, you know, and plus they're invested, just as much as you are invested into your product, because they believe in you. That's why they funded you, you know? So
right.
I think it's definitely a great viable option to the more traditional routes.
So with Energy Hook as still in its alpha state, do you have any idea or any time frame for when it will move into beta or when it will move into public, or is that still way in the future?
Well, on the Kickstarter, I said it would be in beta by November.
Okay.
So I'm trying very hard to hit that. I hope to have it in beta before then, but, you know, I always late, or, you know, a typical game developer, but you know, even if I don't have something that I would personally call beta back when I was working in AAA, like even if it's not feature complete or whatever, I'll make sure that the beta Kickstarter backers get whatever I do have complete at that point. Mm-hmm. As for 1.0, I said it would be done by March of next year. And I really hope I do get it done sooner than that, because I'm going to run out of money before that.
See, I just had one other question. Forgot. Ken, do you have a question fill in while I'm thinking of this next question?
Sure. How did you define your art style? What made you go cel-shaded?
Partly I just like it, but I also And it's partly a reaction to sort of what's trendy today. It seems like so many games are going gritty and bumpy and shiny. You know, I want to stand out, do something different. And then also, there's so many reasons. Also, because it's if you do a cutting edge game, like Spider-Man 2 was pretty close to cutting edge when it came out. Like it sort of fell behind in some areas, but it was also top of the line in other areas. But still, you look at it now, 10 years later, and it's kind of embarrassing. It's like, oh wow, it's like these graphics don't look realistic at all. And people are going to look, hard to imagine, but people are going to look back at Call of Duty today, and they're going to look at those people with their weird sort of uncanny valley faces and all the other weird issues with today's AAA games, and they're going to say, oh weird, that, you know, that doesn't look realistic at all, you know, because games are going to look way cooler in 10 years. But when you do a stylized, abstract-looking game, it looks the way it's supposed to look forever. It's like this is what we tried to make it look like, and we hit that. It's never going to look dated. That was sort of the way it was meant to look. And then there is just budget. Like it does take a team of, you know, 100 people to make a AAA gritty, shiny, buddy, you know, bumpy world. But just me and some. And some stock assets and a little bit of volunteer help. I'm able to do Energy Hook and make it look the way I want it to look.
Yep. And about the having a strong visual style, that's something that we see really in a lot of other independent developer games as well, such as Journey, even something like Binding of Isaac and Team Meat Boy. When you have that strong visual style, you can get away with your game not, you know, pushing your graphics card and every character has to have, you know, detail that you can actually see, like their facial hair. Because as you said, when you go for like that generic or that very gritty, realistic look, it really doesn't have that staying power. Because when you have 12 different games released a year that have that same style, it's just going to all blur together at some point. We talked about this with the game Fuse from Insomniac when they decided to go for more like that gritty look as opposed to the cartoony Team Fortress-esque kind of style, that it basically came out and went out with a whimper. I think everyone stopped talking about it and went down for like 4 or 5 months?
I don't even know.
Case
that's how
point.
Much I forgot about
breaking up there.
Can you hear us now?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you hear the last part about Insomniac and Overstrike or Fuse?
It's Fuse. It was Overstrike, and then they like, I don't know if it was an issue with like focus groups or cost, but they made something that was super stylized and made it overly generic, way too safe. And now it's just like a throwaway game.
Now, going back to Energy Hook, as you said, you're developing the content. The game will have, you know, that kind of zen-like approach of just going around, swinging, and then there are the actual events. In terms of events or actual challenges for the player to achieve, do you have a rough idea of how much, I guess, game time will a player spend going around doing the challenges in Energy Hook?
not really, actually, but I guess I'm imagining there being super rough, no promises, but I was imagining there being, you know, about 10 challenges per level, so that's we're looking at about 60, 70 challenges, depending on how many levels actually make it in there, and then each challenge probably only takes a minute or two, so we're looking at about wherever that is, 140 minutes of solid challenges, and that's if you only do every challenge once. Like if you never try to like improve your time on a race and get the gold medal, or in a trick attack challenge, you never try to get that extra extra points or whatever, then you're looking at 2 to 3 hours of that solid stuff. But then if you actually play each race a few times to get a good time at it, then you've got hours and hours and join the pool.
All right. I think we can start wrapping it up now. Ken, do you have any final questions for Jamie?
Nope.
Okay. I think in that case, we're going to end the cast here. Jamie, it was great to have you on, and yet first, it was great talking about Spider-Man 2, and really can't wait to see Energy Hook, because as we talked about, there really aren't any other games like it on the market.
Yep. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's been fun. I love talking about swinging games.
And hopefully we can have you on another time, either just to talk about other topics in the industry or to see what's going on with Energy Hook.
That'd be great.
In that case, we're going to end it here. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you're interested in either writing a piece for the site or being a future guest, feel free to send us an email. You can find the link and information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. So, with that said, have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.
Good night.
Bye.